you know, with that $3.5 billion deficit figure that's out there and looming every day on our deliberations, you know, it has to be the, you know, the focus of pretty much everything that we're doing. There has been a lot of time and efforts and deliberation spent on looking at ways we can, you know, get ourselves on a path to a sustainable budget. You know, it doesn't matter whether the issue is timber or whether the issue is the Alaska Marine Highway System or whether the issue is the, you know, the oil pipeline, the gas pipeline. You know, that's a figure that's always in the back of our mind, is that $3.5 billion deficit that we're in. And with that said, you know, I have to say that I've been pleased in one sense, and in that I believe that the efforts on the part of the legislature have been not directed at any particular one area or a particular one, you know, group. I think, you know, there's been a concerted effort by the legislators to say, hey, we're all in this together, and everybody's going to need to, you know, to feel the hurt a little bit in order for us to get us on the right path. However, I also will say that in an attempt to draw that deficit down, I do think there's been some examples where the forethought and the planning haven't been sufficient enough to identify what I think would be the long-term net hurt effect, and even hurt on our own budget, of some of these particular cuts. You know, particularly the decision to at this point to close the timber offices in Southeast Alaska and all the way up into Haines. That program brings money into the state coffers. You know, it's the main avenue right now that the timber industry has to get access to resources so that they can, you know, continue to sustain the jobs that are there right now in Southeast Alaska. It's my understanding that there are over 400 jobs associated with the timber industry in Southeast Alaska, and 300 of those jobs are sustained by the activities of those timber offices and looking for ways to get mental health lands, university lands, and state-owned lands up for sale for some of the different timber operators in our region.
And on the timber issue, does it bring in enough money for the state specifically to pay for its own operations?
No question it pays for it. In fact, it brings a lot of positive revenue. When you take a look at what's generated for the state, what's generated for mental health trust, and what's generated for university lands, you're talking about an average of about $3 million to $3.5 million a year annually to those different programs. And so, you know, $1.5 million alone just for the general fund. Certainly, you know, what it costs to operate those particular offices is a lot less than those kinds of figures. So that message is already, in that case, is already starting to be made, and people are starting to listen. So I'm very hopeful that at least some of those funds, and my hope is that a significant sum of those funds are returned to the budget so that we can keep those offices open, maybe with a little less staff, perhaps in each, but that they're open and that they're able to do business, and that those opportunities continue to exist in the future for those few operators that we have in Southeast Alaska now. You know, another, of course, big concern of mine is the Alaska Marine Highway System. The governor had amended his own budget to add back some particular funds to the Alaska Marine Highway System because I think the governor's office recognized the economic importance and you know, the overall service importance that the Marine Highway provides for all of the people in Southeast and Southwest Alaska. And so he had attempted to move back $3.5 million into that to his own budget. And then due to the activities of the Transportation Subcommittee on Finance, you know, they said, no, we're not going to add that money back. In fact, we're going to cut another close to $10 million more, which would devastate the schedule, the services provided of the Alaska Marine Highway System to, you know, to the whole system, not just to Southern Southeast, but to all of Southeast and to Southwest. Everybody's schedules would be significantly reduced under that scenario. And again, you know, if you look at the economic impact of a move like that in terms of, you know, the stops that won't be made, the people that won't be coming, won't be staying in the hotels, won't be staying, going on the different tourism opportunities that are there, we're talking about significant revenue that's lost by a cut like that. And, you know, I think there's no question that the long-term impact, certainly on the economy overall, but even to the state, you know, the state would be foregoing some significant revenue to the ferry system itself. I saw as estimates as high as 6 to 7 million in revenues for ticket sales if those ferries don't run. Again, it's certainly, it may not pay for itself. The ferry system certainly doesn't pay for itself, but during the summer times, it comes darn close, and this is the time when those schedules would be reduced. And so, you know, we're not really saving that much money by tying up those boats, and we're certainly losing a lot of economic activity if those boats remain tied up. And so, again, this would be another example of, I think, the long-term impacts would be much more harmful to the state than the benefits of the saved money in our overall, in our budget. So I think that message is also getting out. I think people are starting to hear that, and I do expect that there'll be some money returned.
It sounds like some folks on the legislature are just really focused on cutting, and they're not necessarily looking at the revenue side when they're making these cuts.
Yeah, well, I hate to characterize it that way, because it, you know, it's pretty clear that if it, you know, if there's any thinking at all going on there, that revenue, if your boats are tied up, that's going to be lost revenue to the Marine Highway System because they're not going to be selling tickets on ships that aren't sailing. You know, I hate to say it, but, you know, there's no other way you can look at it that other than that way. And so hopefully, like I say, hopefully I do think that there was, you know, perhaps an overzealous attempt at perhaps some in the legislature where their goal was more of a number or a percentage of cut without necessarily looking at the ramifications of getting to that number, whatever that number was, or getting to that percentage, not looking at the ramifications and the overall negative impact, at least in some areas of the economy, of getting to that number. And but I think, you know, now my comments and my conversations that I've had with legislators just before I came down here indicate that that message is getting out there, and I'm expecting, while again, certainly not all the money will be returned to the ferry system, I believe a significant portion will be so that they can operate a more substantial schedule than what those cuts would have put into place if in fact they were carried all the way through.
And there were hearings this week on a lot of these budget cuts and
you bet.
Local
and
folks.
Sure, the local folks. I was listening to those comments. They come in from, you know, folks in Ketchikan here and Wrangell and throughout our southern southeast area, and I really appreciate that. You know, I'm a believer in the system and in this example that we have here in our country of what we call a representative republic. And in order for that to work, the public needs to participate in the process and let their voices be heard, so we know what, you know, the thoughts are up in those of us up in Juneau. You know, we often get isolated, and we don't often, you know, get the opportunity to hear really what the thoughts are of the folks out there. And certainly those hearings that were held, those public hearings, brought out a lot of comment and a lot of comment about a lot of different areas of our budget, cuts in education, cuts to public radio. You know, these are all concerns of the folks out there in rural areas. And just a minute on that public radio cut. What became clear, at least from, you know, some of the legislators, was they recently have expressed a greater understanding of how, while in their communities, places like Anchorage, they may have, in fact, 10 different radio stations that consumers can choose from. They've come to the understanding that in a lot of rural areas, you know, public radio is perhaps their only choice in some communities, or the choice of maybe only one other radio station that the local folks have to listen to. And I think the case was well made by this caller, the people who called in about the importance of public radio in terms of not just entertainment, but for community communication, for emergency, you know, situations, all kinds of ways that public radio serves the needs of communities, of small communities in particular, and certainly for us here in Ketchikan. And again, that message, I think, is becoming more clear and more understandable to those Rail Belt legislators, and I'm hoping that some funds are restored to public radio. That 59% overall cut to public radio was certainly significant, and perhaps, not perhaps, it was just a bit too drastic, and I'm hoping to see some of that money returned.
And there were some other concerns brought up during those hearings. Senior services, there were several senior services that people talked about. Can you? Is that another thing that you think might be restored, at least partially?
I haven't. To be honest, I haven't heard much in terms of from other legislators and discussions about that particular area. But it's certainly a concern for me. I knew going up to the legislator, I'd heard from the local community, Ed Zastrow and others, about the importance of funding for the Pioneer Home and other senior services. So when I saw those potential cuts being listed, that immediately raised my concern and my alarm bells. And I understand, from things like the transportation system, the bus system, to the lunch program that we have here in other communities, and then to the Pioneer Home itself. There's a fabric there of support services that are not sufficient as they stand right now. I mean, I think that the demand on senior services has been increasing, and the demographics of our state show that it'll continue to increase. The demand on senior services will continue to increase, and so it certainly makes it a difficult time for us to be looking at significant reductions to those services, because demand for those services are going up and up and up. So I'm not sure where that one's going to go. I'm going to be working hard to put my voice out there as to saying this is another area that we need to look at, is to restore some funding to those areas. And again, that all said, we do have this deficit, and we do have this issue, this overriding issue that it is our responsibility to get our state on a path where we can sustain the spending level that we put forth in our budgets. And therein lies the rub between the real needs that are out there, from transportation to senior services and other areas, and at the same time knowing that in order for us to have any ability to provide those services in the future, we need to put ourselves on a more sustainable budget. So that continues to be the effort, and my hope is that, I'm looking at the midway game here, and I'm looking at the picture of how we're doing that right now, and I'm not entirely or at all pleased at where we are right now, but I'm hopeful that the end game, when we walk out of there in June, at the end of the session, the end game, I think, will be a lot more favorable and a lot more reflective of those immediate needs that we have. And at the same time, hopefully, people will see that we've at least made a very solid effort on getting us on that road to sustainable spending. It is a tough mission. And another big issue that's not even necessarily related at all to budget is the marijuana issue, and we've been spending a lot of time with that as well. And I'm on Community and Regional Affairs Committee, and where that issue comes to us is more in the terms of regulations and community, the level of home control that communities will have, and at the same time putting definitions at least out there, what's public use, so that there's a kind of a statewide understanding of what public use means, things like that we're going into uncharted waters here, and somebody's got to wade into those uncharted waters, and it's been left to this legislature to go down that path. And I've certainly found it quite interesting and frustrating. There's the initiative supporters, I think, were very clear in their goal of having marijuana treated as the way alcohol is treated in our state. But immediately, as soon as you start to look into the issues, they're different substances, and you can't at least entirely treat them the same because of the different elements that marijuana brings to the table that alcohol does not. And don't get me wrong, certainly I'm a believer that the alcohol is, you know, a much more bigger overall issue in our society in causing harm and causing extra costs to budgets and things like that. There's no doubt about that, that alcohol is a bigger issue. At the same time, marijuana is a different element, and you can't necessarily treat it the same way with your specific regulations. And so we're all becoming more and more aware of that. And I think on this one, the end result of this particular session will be more or less an experimentation and see where it leads us. And then maybe come back again in the next session and say, okay, what didn't work out so well? And maybe we can make some corrections to some things that we thought were going to do well, but in the end, maybe find out that they don't work out so well. We'll see. You know, of course, obviously the verdict's out on that. I do think we've been, doing a good job of looking at what's already taken place in places like Colorado and Washington State, and you know, learning some things about their trials and tribulations, and we're showing evidence of applying some of those lessons learned from those other states to the legislation that we're starting to put forward. So at least in that element, it's not completely uncharted waters, because we are looking at where there's problems have been in those other states.
And I'm going to switch topics slightly. Daylight saving time.
You bet.
That could potentially be a big concern for Ketchikan because we are so closely tied to Washington State. But I understand there's a new concept that's been floated that we would eliminate daylight saving time, the change, but we would join Pacific time as an entire state.
I could see where that might have some attraction to the at least the sponsor of the bill, because I spoke to Senator McKinnon about her bill just in a casual breakfast encounter about a week ago, and we chatted there for about 15 minutes, and I gave her the perspective of folks in Southeast in terms of their concerns, and she talked to me about the medical issues and the other kinds of issues that are caused by the time change. And so if we would do something to, like you were saying, you wouldn't have the time change, but we would put us all back one more hour with Pacific time, that might sell. Who knows? But I do think, you know, it's not a positive thing for business and not a positive thing for a lot of other elements of our community, but also for the whole state to put us 5 hours behind East Coast time. That, you know, that seems really problematic, because you know and I know, just as individuals, we wake up with the best of intentions on a particular day to contact those folks on the East Coast, and then all of a sudden it gets to 12:15 and you realize that over there it's 4:15 and getting close to closing time, and sometimes we don't always meet our goals in that situation, and this would make it that much harder if in fact we were 5 hours difference, and then 2 hours difference from Seattle time would also create some problems. So, but hey, you know, it's the democratic process. We're hopefully going to work out something that'll, I'm sure in the end everybody's going to compromise a little bit, and hopefully it'll work out for at least some of the interests of some of the folks.
And then Medicaid expansion. Apparently there's been a little pushback from the other side. They've been having some events recently to try and state their case.
Certainly, yeah. That I was at that particular one of the events that you're speaking of, the luncheon that was held, I believe, Citizens for Prosperity or some organization like that, evidently connections with the Koch brothers and folks who are concerned about Medicaid expansion and the cost on taxpayers. And so I went to that particular presentation, and some concerns were raised. Comparisons were made between states, like Iowa, I think, was one of the states that they said, and I know that Arizona was another one that there were some problems with the expansion of Medicaid. First of all, we're not Iowa and we're not Arizona, you know, and I think that while I think they're good to bring up those concerns, hopefully, you know, in our state, our people who are doing their projections are you know, going to be accurate as to who's going to be signing up and how it'll impact the state, perhaps more accurately than, you know, we're dealing with smaller populations, and perhaps it's a little bit easier for us to get a handle on figures than some of those larger states. You know, certainly Medicaid expansion is not like any, you know, program, private or public. Nothing is perfect. But at the same time, I think there's ample evidence to show that, first of all, we have a significant part of our population that are uninsured. I think the expansion of Medicaid would no doubt help at least a significant portion of that population. I do believe that the statistics show that in many states where it's been expanded, it has saved states money. And there's no doubt that with folks who don't currently have medical insurance, that there's costs to the state already in place, significant costs to the state already in place. It's not like there's no costs involved for folks who don't have insurance right now to the state. By just ignoring it and saying that, oh, well, we don't need to expand Medicaid, the problems don't go away and the costs don't go away. So it's the game that's out there right now, and I do think we need to take a very strong look at it. And obviously the governor has that position as well, and hopefully he'll you know, be able to get enough support in the legislature to give that a go. That's what I'm hoping to see. But of course the verdict's out. You know, we'll see what happens by adjournment day, whether or not he gets that expansion or not.
And I saw that you have introduced a bill to expand criminal charges for child abuse.
Yes, that one came largely due to some constituents that I heard here from the local community. We had that one incident here in Ketchikan that certainly raised some concerns. And so I thought, well, okay, you know, if there wasn't any regulations on board to prevent something like that occurred here in Ketchikan from happening, well, maybe we better put him in there. And so I think that one will get some support once I communicate the issue and why we're bringing it forward, and talk a little bit about the situation that occurred here. Hopefully I'll get support for that bill, and I think I will. I think people are, you know, there's a universal support out there that we all have, you know, concerning children and their safety, and, you know, I think that's a pretty nonpartisan issue, so I'm hoping to get some support for that particular bill.
Where is that now?
Just in the introduction phase. In fact, we haven't had our first hearing on that yet. We've requested a hearing, and I think one is scheduled for next week, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, and what specifically would the bill do?
It would make it so that officials, law enforcement officials, people who are, you know, who work for agencies that deal with the welfare of children, that they can move forward with the legal process or charges, if you will, for folks who they find, or if they find children who are being restrained, you know, unnecessarily. Obviously, there are situations, few situations, but there are situations where children, I'm not going to even say what would merit of that, but
like where they might harm themselves.
Exactly,
or others,
exactly,
or
right. Where, you know, so it doesn't outlaw all restraining of children, but it certainly sends notice that there needs to be well-documented reasons for it to occur, and if not, then criminal steps can be taken towards bringing about a correction of the situation if it's unmerited. Again, you know, I think it came a surprise to everybody that, hey, wait a minute, there wasn't any regulation against this, and there probably should be. So that's the intent of the bill, is to take care of that issue.
Okay, and then your SANER bill. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Again, that came largely due to communication with constituents in the fishing community here. And the concern being that we've reached a point that in order for a young person to, let's say he's an entrepreneur, wants to get involved in the fishing industry and the seining operations, you know, the bar has gotten so high, the amount of investment has, you know, that's required for someone to actually get themselves in the position to make money in a business, in seine operations, if you're just a young man with no family connections or anything like that, that bar is pretty darn high. And while my bill wouldn't lower the bar that much, at least it would keep the bar from continuing to rise, if you will. There already is a 58-foot regulation out there, but there's also the ability, as it stands right now, for that limitation to be waived. That said, I am going to not push this particular bill that hard at this point. Came to my understanding after I put that bill out there for the public that the Fish Board may be looking at that particular issue. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that regulation for the sake of regulation is just not good. So if that issue can be dealt with under the current situation that we have by the bodies that currently weigh in on those topics, then my bill is not needed. And so that one's on pretty much on hold right now. I'm not going to be asking for any hearings on that bill. I'm going to be waiting to see what the Fish Board does and waiting to hear a little bit more from folks perhaps on the other side of the issue. And you know, kind of I put it out there just so the conversation could be had. And I think that conversation is starting to take place. And so now it's just kind of a wait-and-see hold here, and just see what happens through that conversation. Public should know that, you know, I'm very much aware, and other legislators are aware of other concerns that they have, and you know, as to what's happening in the session right now. And getting back to the idea of cuts, potential cuts, I didn't say very much today about cuts in education, but we've certainly heard loud and clear from people in the public out there about concerns to cuts in broadband expansion, for example, or pre-K education. In both of those cases, I think that while some cuts might be merited, the complete way in which they're being proposed right now is of concern to me. And again, we're talking about what's the end game of these cuts, what's the end result. And to me, if you start making significant cuts in pre-K education, those cuts will turn into extra costs down the road in terms of remedial education, in terms of other types of costs that'll confront the state down the road. That's just another example where I'm hoping that we all take a step back and take a good long look and analyze some of these cuts and say, will this really benefit the state? Will it really benefit Alaskans if we make these cuts? Or will it, in fact, cost Alaskans more and cost our budget more in the end if we pursue some of these cuts? And so I just want the public to know that I'm aware of those pretty drastic cuts, and I think some of those we need to look at, and again, partially look at possibly looking at partial restoration of those funds. So,
and it's more than just the pre-K education. There's
all kinds. Yeah, the base student allotment hasn't been touched, and so although the governor, you know, has put forward in his original budget he wants to doesn't want to, but thinks it's necessary to hold back on that one-time funding amount, and I've heard concern from districts on that particular issue. Right now, my position on that particular cut is that while it might not be desirable, you know, I do think the governor made a good faith effort and looking at all aspects of our budget and saying, you know, nobody can go without some reductions. And for education, I think he calculated it would be about a 2.9% reduction if that one-time funding doesn't go through. And while it's not easy, I think maybe, at least right now, I'm not convinced that that's not a cut that we shouldn't be making, because we do have to get ourselves on that budget path.